In the scorching heat of May 1940, as Hitler's tanks rolled across France, most people fled. But Virginia Hall drove her ambulance toward the danger. At 34, with a prosthetic foot causing her constant pain, she had found her purpose in this chaos after years of rejection. While millions escaped, she pressed forward, not for glory or fame, but to restore liberty to her beloved France. This remarkable woman would become the most decorated female civilian of World War II, yet her story remained largely unknown for decades. The Nazis called her the most dangerous Allied spy, and Klaus Barbie, the infamous Butcher of Lyon, offered a fortune for her capture. Her extraordinary courage inspired countless resistance fighters across France, many of whom referred to her with reverence as La Madone. Today, the CIA celebrates Virginia Hall as their greatest female operative, with her portrait hanging in their headquarters, a testament to a woman who refused to let disability, gender, or bureaucracy limit her determination to fight tyranny. Mrs. Barbara Hall had grand designs for her daughter Virginia, born in 1906, marriage into wealth to restore the family's fading social standing. But Virginia defied expectations from childhood, preferring trousers and rifles to feminine attire, proudly wearing live snakes as bracelets, and declaring, "I must have liberty." Though popular and elected to leadership positions at her posh Roland Park Country School, she rejected domestic confinement for adventure. After studying at five prestigious universities across 7 years, Virginia found her true calling in Europe. In 1926, she escaped to Paris, immersing herself in the intellectual ferment of the Anne Falls. She studied at elite institutions in Paris and Vienna, mastering five languages and developing a sophisticated understanding of European politics. When she returned to Maryland in 1929, Virginia applied to the State Department, but was rejected. Women were unwelcome in diplomacy. After her beloved father's sudden death in 1931, Virginia escaped family confinement for a clerk position at the American Embassy in Warsaw. Though she impressed with her initiative, she remained frustrated by her limited role. A transfer to Turkey in 1933 led to catastrophe when she accidentally shot herself in the foot while hunting. Gangrene necessitated amputation below the knee, and during her recovery, she experienced a vision of her father telling her it was her duty to survive. Despite excruciating pain from her ill-fitting wooden prosthetic, Virginia refused invalid status. In Venice, she thrived despite her disability, impressing superiors by handling complex diplomatic tasks. Working tirelessly, she watched with horror as fascism spread across Europe. In 1937, Virginia applied again for diplomatic status, but was rejected, specifically for being an amputee. Despite lobbying by powerful friends to President Roosevelt himself, she could only remain a clerk. Transferred to Estonia as apparent punishment for her ambition, Virginia resigned from the State Department in 1939. When war broke out, she volunteered with the French Ambulance Service, driving wounded soldiers during the Nazi invasion. As France fell, Virginia recognized her unique position as an American with greater freedoms under occupation. Determined to help France reject Nazi rule, she resolved to find a way to fight fascism, a decision that would transform her from frustrated clerk to legendary spy. In August 1940, a chance encounter with British agent George Bellows at the Spanish border changed Virginia's life forever. Impressed by her courage, sharp observations, and passion to help the French fight back, Bellows slipped her the phone number of Nicholas Boddington, a senior officer in Churchill's newly formed Special Operations Executive, SOE. SOE had been created with Churchill's directive to set Europe ablaze through sabotage and resistance. When Virginia contacted Boddington, he immediately recognized her potential as SOE's first female agent. Despite the State Department's reluctance to assist her and the immense dangers of the mission, Virginia eagerly accepted the challenge of entering France as a secret liaison officer, the first opportunity that valued her abilities rather than dismissing them because of her disability. Her training was minimal compared to later recruits, just days learning coding, clandestine warfare basics, security protocols, and weapons handling. With virtually no intelligence on conditions in France, her preparation could scarcely prepare her for the dangers ahead. In August 1941, she departed for Vichy, France with a journalistic cover and the codename Diane. No one in London gave Agent 3844 better than 50-50 odds of surviving her first days. Dispatching a one-legged 35-year-old woman on a blind mission into wartime France seemed almost insane. But Virginia would prove them wrong in ways that would astonish even her handlers. In Vichy, she established her journalistic cover while secretly gathering intelligence through a network of 90 contacts. This network supplied vital information on ammunition depots, troop movements, and even a Nazi submarine base that was later bombed. Finding Vichy too small and heavily surveilled, Virginia relocated to Lyon, whose labyrinthine layout and seditious history made it ideal for resistance activities. Virginia transformed herself, dyeing her once red hair brown, adopting modest tweed suits, and developing techniques to quickly alter her appearance. She established crucial communication channels through American Vice Consul George Whittinghill, who smuggled her reports to Switzerland via diplomatic pouch. By September 1941, as SOE operations expanded rapidly, Virginia prepared to receive a dozen new agents arriving by parachute and sea, the beginning of what would become one of the most effective resistance networks in occupied France. Virginia built her network through brilliant recruitment of people the Nazis would never suspect. Her first allies were the nuns at the St. Elizabeth Convent, who provided her initial lodging. But her most unexpected alliance came through Germaine Guérin, a burning brunette who owned one of Lyon's most successful brothels. Introduced by RAF pilot William Simpson, Germaine became a crucial asset, providing safe houses heated with illicit coal and intelligence from her girls who extracted information from German officers. Virginia affectionately called these women her tart friends, who not only gathered intelligence, but sometimes administered heroin to German clients, rendering them addicted and unfit for duty. Dr. Jean Rousset, a gynecologist for Lyon's prostitutes with a rakish mustache, became Virginia's most valuable assistant, codenamed Papa. From his office, he treated injured agents, received messages, and even established a fake lunatic asylum as a safe house. Germans avoided places with apparent mental patients. Her greatest coup was infiltrating the Servette by recruiting officer Marcel Leccia, his assistant, and even his boss, providing crucial protection against future traps. She expanded her network with remarkable efficiency, recruiting a diverse array of helpers, a scent manufacturer, elderly spinsters with an antique shop, a lingerie store owner who hid weapons under lacy bras, hairdressers, laundry owners, factory owners, and even a respectable engraver who forged documents. Virginia worked tirelessly to unite disparate resistance factions under SOE's umbrella, traveling extensively despite harsh winter conditions on antiquated, overcrowded trains. She maintained her journalist cover while secretly sending sensitive political intelligence to SOE, earning praise as amazingly successful with inspired fieldcraft. Despite her success, she faced constant dangers, brutal winter conditions without heat or soap, and the loneliness of clandestine work. Her wooden leg made her conspicuous as La Dame qui boite, the limping lady, yet she persevered. By summer 1942, Virginia had established herself as the most effective Allied agent in France, coordinating a vast network that provided crucial intelligence while preparing for eventual armed resistance against the occupiers. The shortage of safe houses meant most wireless operators ended up at Virginia's apartment, where the hallway resembled a bird's nest of aerials tacked across the walls. Though some considered this arrangement extremely insecure, Virginia maintained that whoever protected the pianists controlled communications with London, and she was determined to maintain that control, even as German detection vans circled Lyon hunting for radio signals. By mid-1942, Virginia faced a direct order to return to London when Baker Street learned the American consul had been interrogated about her. The recall came through her newspaper with a curt message that her work was appreciated, but it was time to discuss her future. This wording outraged Virginia. After surviving 9 months in the field with minimal support from London, she believed she should judge whether her security was compromised. Virginia employed delaying tactics, blaming atmospheric conditions for communication difficulties while enlisting colleagues to advocate for her continued presence. She promised to scale down operations and change apartments again, but she had no intention of abandoning her work, especially with a critical mission in the planning stages. 12 SOE agents, the Clan Cameron Group, were imprisoned in the freezing fortress of Perigueux in southwest France. Half British and half French, these men had been captured in a trap and left to languish for 6 months in degrading conditions with minimal food, no heat, and rampant disease. Baker Street was desperate to rescue these skilled operatives, but seemed incapable of helping them. Virginia orchestrated an audacious escape plan. She enlisted Gobby, who smuggled tools hidden in food parcels, tiny files in jam jars, wire cutters in laundry, and tools in hollowed books. Despite being repeatedly denounced and searched, Gobby never faltered. Virginia recruited Vic, chief of an escape line, to arrange safe houses and transportation over the Pyrenees. She organized papers, ration cards, and train tickets for the escapees. Communication remained challenging until a bold solution emerged. A legless French priest visiting the camp smuggled in a wireless transmitter hidden where his legs should be. Soon, direct contact with Baker Street was established, even transmitting intelligence about a German munitions factory that was subsequently bombed by the RAF. The escape faced several challenges: a problematic key that initially didn't work, a prisoner threatening to inform guards, and a message accidentally delivered to the wrong person. The mess sergeant who discovered their plan demanded 50,000 francs for his silence, which Virginia promptly supplied. On July 15th, after receiving Virginia's final signal via an old lady passing the camp, the operation commenced. They drugged the reluctant prisoner with sleeping potion, and at 3 a.m., after hours of tense waiting, the guard gave the signal. The door was unlocked, replaced with a painted sackcloth decoy, and the fence crossing prepared with carpet to protect them from barbed wire. One by one, 12 men escaped through the wire in just 12 minutes. They fled to a waiting truck, which transported them to a safe house 20 miles away stocked with supplies. Virginia's thoughtful touch included soap and razors. The escape triggered an unprecedented manhunt, with road closures, checkpoints, and systematic searches. Virginia cleverly spread rumors through her network that the men had been picked up by RAF bombers, hoping to convince authorities they were already in England. After hiding for 2 weeks until the search diminished, the escapees traveled separately to Lyon's Grand Nouvel Hotel, where Virginia awaited them. She quickly dispersed them to various safe houses, some staying with resistance hairdressers, others possibly at Germaine's brothel. By August 11, London received confirmation that all Clan Cameron members had safely reached Lyon. The Mazak breakout sent shockwaves through Nazi high command, triggering Hitler's brutal crackdown in France. The escape proved the resistance posed a significant threat and demonstrated Pétain's administration couldn't be trusted to eliminate the enemy within. Berlin prepared for full occupation, issuing 500 French identity cards to the Gestapo to infiltrate Allied networks across the Free Zone. The Nazis honeycombed southern cities with double agents, targeting Lyon as their primary focus. Both the Gestapo and rival Abwehr placed the American consulate under surveillance, suspecting Virginia's involvement. The Abwehr had deduced their target was a limping woman called Marie Monat, but methodically gathered intelligence before striking. Meanwhile, the notorious Klaus Barbie, who would later receive the Iron Cross for torturing thousands of resistance, developed an obsessive determination to crush SOE, conducting constant raids from the hotel terminus. The limping Lady of Lyon was becoming the Nazis' most wanted agent in France. Virginia's encounter with Abbe Robert Allèche proved catastrophic. Though initially suspicious, she was reassured by his credentials, including a handwritten note from her contact Jacques Legrand. Allèche claimed his father had been shot by Germans and delivered seemingly valuable intelligence on the Atlantic Wall. Virginia's confidence wavered when she learned her network had been devastated by arrests, information Allèche had concealed. Despite these concerns and Baker Street's advice to cut ties, Virginia, perhaps from exhaustion or overconfidence, continued working with Alesh. This proved disastrous. Alesh was actually Agent Axel of the Abwehr, a Luxembourg native who had approached German intelligence to advance his ambitions. He had betrayed an entire circuit, leading to numerous arrests and deaths. By October, the Abwehr had penetrated Virginia's network deeply enough to intercept and break her coded messages. Recognizing her increasing danger, Virginia finally asked London to arrange her departure. "I think my time has come," she reported, noting her address had been given to Vichy. On November 8, as 100,000 Allied troops landed in North Africa, Virginia realized she must flee immediately. She caught the last train south from Lyon at 11 o'clock, just before the Germans arrived. Virginia traveled overnight to Perpignan, near the Spanish border. There, she contacted a guide, who warned that crossing the treacherous 8,000-foot Pyrenees Pass would be extremely dangerous, especially in November with waist-high snow and freezing winds. Despite stories of guides abandoning struggling escapees, Virginia insisted on departing immediately, offering to pay 55,000 francs for herself and two other escapees. She kept her prosthetic leg's existence hidden, knowing it would doom any chance of finding a willing guide. On November 11, the Wehrmacht stormed into the Free Zone. In Lyon, Klaus Barbie offered a large reward for information leading to Virginia's arrest, later screaming, "I'd give anything to get my hands on that limping Canadian bitch." He ordered thousands of wanted posters with Virginia's likeness, splashed with the words, "The enemy's most dangerous spy. We must find and destroy her." Virginia and her companions began their grueling journey over the Pyrenees. She carried her heavy bag on her right side to disguise her limp as they climbed through increasingly steep, snow-covered terrain. After hours of climbing, they faced the most brutal 12-mile stretch, a 5,000-foot climb in cruel winter conditions. With a precipice on one side and steep mountain on the other, Virginia endured excruciating pain as blood seeped from her stump, but she pushed forward step by step. At the Mantet Pass, 6,000 feet, they briefly rested in a shepherd's hut. Here, Virginia likely sent her legendary message to London. "Cuthbert is being tiresome, but I can cope," to which a confused duty officer replied, "If Cuthbert is tiresome, have him eliminated." Cuthbert was her nickname for her prosthetic leg. On Friday the 13th, they reached the 8,000-foot summit, where the guide took the rest of Virginia's money and turned back. They continued another 20 miles through the bitter night, driven by thoughts of reaching the Barcelona consulate. Virginia's prosthetic was falling apart, and descending was even more treacherous than climbing. An official report later called Virginia's crossing a record all by itself. But at San Juan station, waiting for the train to Barcelona, they were discovered by civil guards, who arrested them as undocumented and destitute refugees. After her eventual release, Virginia was forced to remain in Madrid on a frustrating assignment as a Chicago Times correspondent. Despite her extraordinary success exfiltrating agents from France, her SOME superiors deemed her unqualified to run an escape line independently, relegating her to courier work and suggesting her primary usefulness would be giving and accepting entertainment, like tea parties. By September 1943, Virginia had reached her breaking point. "I have given it a good 4 months' try," she wrote, "but staying in Madrid was a waste of time and money." She requested to return to France as a radio operator. "My neck is my own, and I am willing to get a crick in it because there is a war on." Her request was denied. In March 1944, Virginia Hall, now disguised as elderly peasant Marcel Montagne and working for American OSS instead of British SOE, returned to France. After passing through Gestapo checkpoints with her wireless transmitter, she established herself in central France, strategically located between the Channel and Mediterranean coasts. Virginia embraced her cover as a milkmaid, driving cows to pasture while identifying fields for parachute drops. she began recruiting locals for the resistance, from the mayor's secretary to the village postman, transforming peasant squads into organized guerrilla units. She even sold cheese to German officers to gather intelligence on their movements and plans. With D-Day approaching, Virginia received orders to assess resistance capabilities and plan sabotage operations. She chose the dangerous but strategically vital Nivre region, working with Colonel Vessereau to organize men into an effective guerrilla force. She taught them small-scale sabotage techniques and arranged for parachute drops of weapons and explosives. Virginia next moved to Surrey-en-Vaux in the Cher, one of the hardest areas to penetrate in central France. Continuing her peasant disguise, she tended goats while observing German troop movements despite the area being heavily mined and patrolled. Despite filthy spring weather, she gathered intelligence daily, transmitting to London each night. When D-Day finally arrived on June 6, 1944, Virginia's groups sprang into action, cutting telephone wires, blowing up bridges, removing signposts, and planting explosives to delay German reinforcements rushing north. Virginia traveled hundreds of miles by bicycle to coordinate with resistance groups, arranging weapons drops in a chaotic landscape where both Nazi reprisals and bandit violence threatened civilians. Virginia had become a power in the French countryside, effectively deciding which resistance groups would receive Allied support. After carefully vetting Count de Vogue's men, she arranged for weapons drops and funding within 5 days. Count de Vogue later recalled her courage, authority, and decisive spirit, calling her a remarkable figure of the resistance army. By late June, Virginia was severely overextended, transmitting from multiple Maquis groups across 3 departments while providing crucial intelligence on German troop movements. Her success triggered brutal Nazi reprisals. In response to her Cohn's group's ambushes, the Gestapo torched 3 villages with flamethrowers and massacred 27 residents. Male OSS agents arriving in the field were astounded by Virginia's capabilities. Lieutenant Paul Martineau observed her directing guerrilla activities with the assurance and good humor of a Sunday school teacher arranging a picnic. By this point, Virginia had orchestrated 15 parachute drops, supplying arms, ammunition, operators, organizers, food, and medicine. She had armed 800 fighters who formed the nucleus of forces that quickly grew to 12,000 combat-ready men. After the war, Virginia joined the newly formed CIA, hoping to continue meaningful intelligence work. Instead, she faced continued discrimination despite her exceptional qualifications. In 1957, her situation improved slightly when she transferred to the Western Hemisphere desk, where her versatility, intelligence, and competence were finally recognized as she conducted operations against communism in South America. That same year, Virginia and Paul Goyot, a fellow OSS agent she had met in France, quietly married after years together. At 51, Virginia faced the double disadvantage of age and marriage in the CIA's culture, where married women were considered less reliable. E. Howard Hunt noted her low-level status and how she was an embarrassment to the non-combat CIA types. Though she finally received a promotion to GS-14, equivalent to Lieutenant Colonel, in 1959, one of only 5 women in covert operations to reach this rank, it was her sole advancement in 14 years. Her supervisors continued assigning her work below her abilities. When the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion occurred in 1961, Virginia privately told her niece she was glad it was glad it wasn't one of mine. She retired at the mandatory age of 60 in 1966, but unlike most officers of her caliber, received no offer to continue as a consultant. The CIA later admitted in a secret report that colleagues felt she had been sidelined because she overshadowed her male colleagues who felt threatened by her. In retirement, Virginia and Paul created a comfortable life in their French-style Barnesville, Maryland home. She devoted herself to gardening, planting thousands of daffodils and growing vegetables. They kept goats for making cheese, raised geese for foie gras, and spent hours cooking together. Virginia refused to discuss her wartime exploits, telling her niece she had seen too many corpses of colleagues who had talked. Virginia's legacy finally received proper recognition after her death in 1982. Though undervalued during her CIA career, she was eventually acknowledged as an unqualified heroine whose talents had been squandered. In 1988, she was posthumously inducted into the Military Intelligence Corps Hall of Fame. A 2006 ceremony featured a tribute from President Jacques Chirac, honoring her as an American friend and true hero of the French Resistance. The CIA now prominently celebrates Virginia's legacy. A painting depicting her transmitting radio messages with a young resistance fighter hangs in CIA headquarters, with copies displayed worldwide. In 2016, the agency named the Virginia Hall Expeditionary Center after her, where new recruits learn about her extraordinary achievements. Virginia's pioneering work establishing resistance networks continues to influence modern special operations. The CIA acknowledges that its Jawbreaker team deployed to Afghanistan after 9/11 followed the direct lineage of her secret operations with the French Resistance. Her nemesis, Klaus Barbie, was finally brought to justice in 1987, convicted of crimes against humanity in Lyon and imprisoned until his death in 1991. In France, her beloved resistance fighters from the Haute-Lavoie shared their grief at losing Lama Dan, the woman who had shown them hope, comradeship, courage, and the way to be the best version of themselves. Until the last of them died in 2017, they remembered her with Les étoiles dans les yeux, stars in their eyes, a fitting tribute to a woman who refused to let disability, gender, or bureaucracy limit her determination to fight tyranny.